I read you about his 10th year. This is the 10th year, AD 4. He was born 7 BC on August 21st. Well, if I believed in the signs of the zodiac, I would say that's an auspicious day. He's now 10 years old, and this is AD 4. It was the 5th of July, this first Sabbath of the month, when Jesus, while strolling through the countryside with his father, first gave expressions to feelings and ideas which indicated that he was becoming self-conscious of the unusual nature of his life mission. Joseph listened attentively to the momentous words of his son, but made few comments. He volunteered no information. The next day, Jesus had a similar but longer talk with his mother. Mary likewise listened to the pronouncements of the lad, but neither did she volunteer any information. It was almost 2 years before Jesus again spoke to his parents concerning this increasing revelation within his own consciousness regarding the nature of his personality and the character of his mission on earth. He entered the advanced school of the synagogue in August. At school, he was constantly creating trouble for the questions he persisted in asking. Increasingly, he kept all Nazareth in more or less of a hubbub. His parents were loath to forbid his asking these disquieting questions, and his chief teacher was greatly intrigued by the lad's curiosity, insight, and hunger for knowledge. Jesus' playmates saw nothing supernatural in his conduct. In most ways, he was altogether like themselves. His interest in study was somewhat above the average, but not wholly unusual. He did ask more questions at school than others in his class. Perhaps his most unusual and outstanding trait was his unwillingness to fight for his rights. Since he was such a well-developed lad for his age, it seemed strange to his playfellows that he was disinclined to defend himself even from injustice when subjected to personal abuse. As it happened, he did not suffer much on account of this trait because of the friendship of Jacob, a neighbor boy who was 1 year older. He was the son of the stonemason, a business associate of Joseph. Jacob was a great admirer of Jesus and made it his business to see that no one was permitted to impose upon Jesus because of his aversion to physical combat. Several times, older and uncouth youths attacked Jesus, relying upon his reputed docility, but they always suffered swift and certain retribution at the hands of his self-appointed champion and ever-ready defender, Jacob the stonemason's son. Jesus was the generally accepted leader of the Nazareth lads, who stood for the highest ideals of their day and generation. He was really loved by his youthful associates, not only because he was fair, but also because he possessed a rare and understanding sympathy that betokened on love and bordered on discreet compassion. This year, he began to show a marked preference for the company of older persons. He delighted in talking over things cultural, educational, social, economic, political, and religious with older minds. And his depth of reasoning and keenness of observation so charmed his adult associates that they were always more than willing to visit with him. Until he became responsible for the support of the home, his parents were constantly seeking to influence him to associate with those of his own age, or more nearly his age, rather than with older, better informed individuals for whom he evinced such a preference. Late this year, he had a fishing experience of 2 months with his uncle in the Sea of Galilee, and he was very successful. Before attaining manhood, he had become an expert fisherman. His physical development continued. He was an advanced and privileged pupil at school. He got along fairly well at home with his younger brothers and sisters, having the advantage of being 3.5 years older than the oldest of the other children. He was well thought of in Nazareth, except for the parents of some of the duller children, who often spoke of Jesus as being too pert, as lacking in proper humility and youthful reserve. Human nature hasn't changed very much, has it? He manifested a growing tendency to direct the play activities of his youthful associates into more serious and thoughtful channels. He was a born teacher and simply could not refrain from so functioning even when supposedly engaged in play. Joseph early began to instruct Jesus in the diverse means of gaining a livelihood, explaining the advantages of agriculture over industry and trade. Galilee was a more beautiful and prosperous district than Judea, and it cost only about 1/4 as much to live there as in Jerusalem and Judea. It was a province of agricultural villages and thriving industrial cities, containing more than 200 towns of over 5,000 population and 30 of over 15,000. When on his first trip with his father to observe the fishing industry on the Lake of Galilee, Jesus had just about made up his mind to become a fisherman. But close association with his father's vocation later on influenced him to become a carpenter, while still later a combination of influences led him to the final choice of becoming a religious teacher of a new order. Read about his 15th year. This is 89. Are you interested in this?
Yes.
Fine. By the middle of his 15th year, and we are reckoning time in accordance with the 20th century calendar, not with the Jewish year, Jesus had taken a firm grasp upon the management of his family. His father died the preceding year, was killed accidentally. Before this year had passed, their savings had about disappeared, and they were face to face with the necessity of disposing of one of the Nazareth houses which Joseph and his neighbor Jacob owned in partnership. Joseph was more than a carpenter. At the time of his death, he was a rather prosperous contractor. On Wednesday evening, April 17th, 89, Ruth, the baby of the family, was born. And to the best of his ability, Jesus endeavored to take the place of his father in comforting and ministering to his mother during this trying and peculiarly sad ordeal. For almost a score of years until he began his public ministry, no father could have loved and nurtured his daughter any more affectionately and faithfully than Jesus cared for little Ruth. And he was an equally good father to all the other members of his family. During this year, Jesus first formulated the prayer which he subsequently taught his apostles, and which to many has become known as the Lord's Prayer. In a way, it was an evolution of the family altar. They had many forms of praise and several formal prayers. After his father's death, Jesus tried to teach the older children to express themselves individually in prayer, much as he so enjoyed doing, but they could not grasp his thought and would invariably fall back upon their memorized prayer forms. It was in this effort to stimulate his older brothers and sisters to say individual prayers that Jesus would endeavor to lead them along by suggestive phrases, and presently, without intention on his part, it developed that they were all using a form of prayer which was largely built up from these suggestive lines which Jesus had taught them. At last, Jesus gave up the idea of having each member of the family formulate spontaneous prayers, and one evening in October, he sat down to the little squat lamp on the low stone table and on a piece of smooth cedar board about 18 inches square with a piece of charcoal he wrote out the prayer, which became from that time on the standard family petition. Would you like me to read you that prayer? It's given elsewhere in the book. Does anybody know quickly where it is? I've got it here. Lucky. I'm lucky I've got it.
1620.
Yeah. Our Father, who is in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our bread for tomorrow. Refresh our souls with the water of life. And forgive everyone, and forgive us everyone our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors. Save us in temptation. Deliver us from evil. And increasingly, make us perfect, like yourself. It's very close to what we have. This year, Jesus was much troubled with confused thinking. Family responsibilities had quite effectively removed all thought of immediately carrying out any plan for responding to the Jerusalem visitation, directing him to be about his Father's business. Jesus rightly reckoned that the watch care of his earthly family must take precedence of all duties, that the support of his family must become his first obligation. In the course of this year, Jesus found a passage in the so-called Book of Enoch, which influenced him later in the adoption of the term Son of Man as a designation for his bestowal mission on Urantia. He had thoroughly considered the idea of the Jewish Messiah and was firmly convinced that he was not to be that Messiah. He longed to help his Father's people, but he never expected to lead Jewish armies in overthrowing the foreign domination of Palestine. He knew he would never sit on the throne of David at Jerusalem. Neither did he believe that his mission was that of a spiritual deliverer or moral teacher solely to the Jewish people. In no sense, therefore, could his life mission be the fulfillment of the intense longings and supposed messianic prophecies of the Hebrew Scriptures, at least not as the Jews understood these predictions of the prophets. Likewise, he was certain that he was never to appear as the Son of Man depicted by the prophet Daniel. But when the time came for him to go forth as a world teacher, what would he call himself? What claim should he make concerning his mission? By what name would he be called by the people who would become believers in his teaching? The great confusion of Jesus' younger days now arose. Having settled something about the nature of his mission on earth to be about his Father's business, to show forth his Father's loving nature to all mankind, he began to ponder anew the many statements in the Scriptures referring to the coming of a national deliverer, a Jewish teacher or king. To what event did these prophecies refer? Was he not a Jew, or was he? Was he or was he not of the house of David? His mother averred he was. His father had ruled, but he was not. He decided he was not. But had the prophets confused the nature and mission of the Messiah? His profound periods of meditation, his frequent journeys to the hilltop for prayer, and the many ideas which Jesus advanced from time to time thoroughly alarmed his mother. Sometimes she thought the lad was beside himself, and then she would steady her fears, remembering that he was, after all, a child of promise, and in some manner different from other youths. But Jesus was learning not to speak of all his thoughts, not to present all his ideas to the world, not even to his own mother. From this year on, Jesus' disclosures about what was going on in his mind steadily diminished. That is, he talked less about those things which an average person could not grasp and which would lead to his being regarded as peculiar or different from ordinary folks. To all appearances, he became commonplace and conventional. though he did long for someone who could understand his problems. He craved a trustworthy and confidential friend, but his problems were too complex for his human associates to comprehend. The uniqueness of the unusual situation compelled him to bear his problems alone. Gradually, Jesus and his family returned to the simple life of their earlier years. Their clothes and even their food became simpler. They had plenty of milk, butter, and cheese. In season, they enjoyed the produce of their garden. But each passing month necessitated the practice of greater frugality. Their breakfasts were very plain. They saved their best food for the evening meal. However, among these Jews, lack of wealth did not imply social inferiority. Already had this youth well nigh encompassed the comprehension of how men lived in his day, and how well he understood life in the home, field, and workshop is shown by his subsequent teachings, which so repletely reveal his intimate contact with all phases of human experience. The Nazareth Kazan continued to cling to the belief that Jesus was to become a great teacher, probably the successor of the renowned Gamaliel at Jerusalem. Apparently, all Jesus' plans for a career were thwarted. The future did not look bright as matters now developed, but he did not falter. He was not discouraged. He lived on day by day, doing well the present duty and faithfully discharging the immediate responsibilities of his station in life. Jesus' life is the everlasting comfort of all disappointed idealists. The pay of a common day laboring carpenter was slowly diminishing. By the end of this year, Jesus could earn, by working early and late, only the equivalent of about 25 cents a day. But by the next year, they found it difficult to pay the civil taxes, not to mention the synagogue assessments and the temple tax of 1/2 shekel. During this year, the tax collector tried to squeeze extra revenue out of Jesus, even threatening to take his heart. Fearing that the copy of the Greek scriptures might be discovered and confiscated by the tax collectors, Jesus, on his 15th birthday, presented it to the Nazareth Synagogue Library as his maturity offering to the Lord. The great shock of his 15th year came when Jesus went over to Sepphoris to receive the decision of Herod regarding the appeal taken to him in the dispute about the amount of money due Joseph at the time of his accidental death. Jesus and Mary hoped for the receipt of a considerable sum of money when the treasurer at Sepphoris had offered them a paltry amount. Joseph's brothers had taken an appeal to Herod himself, and now Jesus stood in the palace and heard Herod decree that his father had nothing due him at the time of his death. And for such an unjust decision, Jesus never again trusted Herod Antipas. It is not surprising that he once alluded to Herod as that fox. The close work at the carpenter's bench during this and subsequent years deprived Jesus of the opportunity of mingling with the caravan passengers. The family supply shop had already been taken over by his uncle, and Jesus worked altogether at the home shop, where he was near to help Mary with the family. About this time, he began sending James, his oldest brother, up to the camel lot to gather information about world events, and thus he sought to keep in touch with the news of the day. As he grew up to manhood, he passed through all those conflicts and confusions which the average young persons of previous and subsequent ages have undergone. And the rigorous experience of supporting his family was a sure safeguard against his having overmuch time for idle meditation or the indulgence of mystic tendencies. This was the year Jesus rented a considerable piece of land just to the north of their home, which was divided up as a family garden plot. Each of the older children had an individual garden, and they entered into keen competition in their agricultural efforts. Their eldest brother spent some time with them in the garden each day during the season of vegetable cultivation. As Jesus worked with his younger brothers and sisters in the garden, He many times entertained the wish that they were all located on a farm out in the country, where they could enjoy the liberty and freedom of an unhampered life. But they did not find themselves growing up in the country. And Jesus, being a thoroughly practical youth as well as an idealist, intelligently and vigorously attacked his problem just as he found it, and did everything within his power to adjust himself and the family to the realities of their situation and to adapt their condition to the highest possible satisfaction of their individual and collective longings. At one time, Jesus faintly hoped that he might be able to gather up sufficient means, provided they could collect the considerable sum of money due his father for work on Herod's palace, to warrant undertaking the purchase of a small farm. He'd really given serious thought to this plan of moving his family out into the country. But when Herod refused to pay them any of the funds due Joseph, they gave up the ambition of owning a home in the country. As it was, they contrived to enjoy much of the experience of farm life, as they now had 3 cows, 4 sheep, a flock of chickens, a donkey, and a dog, in addition to the doves. Even the little tots had their regular duties to perform in the well-regulated scheme of management which characterized the home life of this Nazareth family. With the close of this 15th year, Jesus completed the traversal of that dangerous and difficult period of human existence, that time of transition between the more complacent years of childhood and the consciousness of approaching manhood, with its increased responsibilities and opportunities for the acquirement of advanced experience in the development of a noble character. The growing period for mind and body had ended. And now began the real career of this young man of Nazareth. Those chairs must be getting hard.
Shouldn't we stop? Just said yeah. There wouldn't be much juvenile delinquency if families are raising their children that way.
No, that's right. They were busy. Isn't that a lovely story?
Yeah. It's in this book also when Jesus began to do the miracles, and it said, is it explained how these miracles happened?
And which ones didn't happen, and some of them did. He was, after all, a creator.
Yeah. And
just to intrigue you, just to intrigue you, the widow's son at Nain was not dead. He was in a coma. And when Jesus tried to tell the group that he wasn't dead, and he was merely averting a tragedy, the burying of a live person, they simply said, look at him, isn't he modest? You see, they were miracle-minded. They would read a miracle into any event. But Lazarus was dead and had been dead for 3 days and bodily corruption had set in. That was really something. You know, they look for miracles. If I saw one, I wouldn't believe it. I'd look for the mirrors and the piano wires and I'd say, Houdini or Thurston's around here somewhere. We're a skeptical generation. Shall we? Yes.
Where was Lazarus' soul during that period?
His guardian angel had it. And the Father's indwelling spirit had received prior orders to stand by. And as the papers point out, the technical restoration of Lazarus' physical body was a much tougher job for the biologists and the technicians that had to do it than it would be to do the normal thing, taking him on to the mansion world. This involved the actual reconstruction of Lazarus' body. And they did such a beautiful job of reconstruction that many, many years later, when he died of the same thing the second time. They rebuilt the weakness. It was a true restoration. When you read about the host of personalities that are down here, this was worse than a World Series, you know. Anybody in this universe that could get the transit was down here watching this. And they had plenty of technically competent people. I'll tell you, I think the most Want me to read you about the water and the wine at Cana?
Yes.
Can you take more?
The wedding, the
marriage feast of Cana.
That true.
You know?
Sure.
I remember the first time I read this paper, and I knew it wasn't going to happen. It's such a cute story, and I think it is sublimely humorous. Yes. No, this isn't too bad, too long. You see, the news is kind of broken, and Jesus has become by now a minor celebrity in the environs of Nazareth. By noon on Wednesday, almost 1,000 guests had arrived in Cana, more than four times the number bidden to the wedding feast. It was the Jewish customs to celebrate weddings on Wednesday, and the invitations had been sent abroad for the wedding 1 month previously. In the forenoon and early afternoon, it appeared more like a public reception for Jesus than a wedding. Everyone wanted to greet this near-famous Galilean, and he was most cordial to all, young and old, Jew and Gentile. And everybody rejoiced when Jesus consented to lead the preliminary wedding procession. Jesus was now thoroughly self-conscious regarding his human existence, his divine pre-existence, and the status of his combined or fused human and divine natures. With perfect poise, he could at one moment enact the human role or immediately assume the personality prerogatives of the divine nature. As the day wore on, Jesus became increasingly conscious that the people were expecting him to perform some wonder. More especially, he recognized that his family and his six disciple apostles, the other six were yet to be chosen, were looking for him appropriately to announce his forthcoming kingdom by some startling and supernatural manifestation. Early in the afternoon, Mary summoned James, and together they made bold to approach Jesus to inquire if he would admit them to his confidence, to the extent of informing them at what hour and at what point in connection with wedding ceremonies he had planned to manifest himself as the supernatural one. On the way to Cana, it says, Mary had not been so joyous in years. She journeyed to Cana in the spirit of the Queen Mother on the way to witness the coronation of her son. No sooner had they spoken of these matters to Jesus than they saw they had aroused his characteristic indignation. He said only, "If you love me, then be willing to tarry with me, while I wait upon the will of my Father who is in heaven." But the eloquence of his rebuke lay in the expression of his face. This move of his mother was a great disappointment to the human Jesus, and he was much sobered by his reaction to her suggestive proposal that he permit himself to indulge in some outward demonstration of his divinity. That was one of the very things he had decided not to do when so recently isolated in the hills. For several hours, Mary was much depressed. She said to James, "I cannot understand it. What can it all mean? Is there no end to his strange conduct?" James and Jude tried to comfort their mother, while Jesus withdrew for an hour's solitude. But he returned to the gathering and was once more lighthearted and joyous. The wedding proceeded with a hush of expectancy. I should explain to you that at the time of the Jordan, the Spirit of God which indwelt the human Jesus left him permanently. The technical name for this spirit is an adjuster. And this adjuster received personality in his own name and right. And it was this adjuster which spoke at the Jordan, saying, "This is my beloved son, hearken to him." This personalized adjuster will appear in this story, and it just occurred to me you didn't know who he was. This is the spirit which formerly indwelt Jesus and which no longer does, now that he is enacting the role of a divine son. The wedding proceeded with a hush of expectancy, but the entire ceremony was finished and not a move, not a word from the honored guest. Can you feel the tension building up? Then it was whispered about that the carpenter and boat builder, announced by John as the deliverer, would show his hand during the evening festivities, perhaps at the wedding supper. But all expectance of such a demonstration was effectually removed from the minds of his six disciple apostles when he called them together just before the wedding supper, and in great earnestness said, "Think not that I have come to this place to work some wonder for the gratification of the curious or for the conviction of those who doubt. Rather are we here to wait upon the will of our Father who is in heaven." But when Mary and the others saw him in consultation with his associates, they were fully persuaded in their own minds that something extraordinary was about to happen, and they all sat down to enjoy the wedding supper and the evening of festive good fellowship. The father of the bridegroom had provided plenty of wine for all the guests bidden to the marriage feast, but how was he to know that the marriage of his son was to become an event so closely associated with the expected manifestation of Jesus as the messianic deliverer? He was delighted to have the honor of numbering the celebrated Galilean among his guests. But before the wedding supper was over, the servants brought him the disconcerting news that the wine was running short. By the time the formal supper had ended and the guests were strolling about in the garden, the mother of the bridegroom confided to Mary that the supply of wine was exhausted, and Mary confidently said, "Have no worry, I will speak to my son. He will help us." And thus did she presume to speak, notwithstanding the rebuke of but a few hours before. Throughout a period of many years, Mary had always turned to Jesus for help in every crisis of their home life in Nazareth, so that it was only natural for her to think of him at this time. But this ambitious mother had still other motives for appealing to her eldest son on this occasion. As Jesus was standing alone in the corner of the garden, his mother approached him, saying, "My son, they have no wine." And Jesus said, "My good woman, what have I to do with that?" Said Mary, "But I believe your hour has come. Cannot you help us?" Jesus replied, "I can, I declare, but I have not come to do things in this wise. Why do you trouble me again with these matters?" And breaking down in tears, Mary entreated him, "But my son, I promised them that you would help us. Won't you please do something for me?" And then spoke Jesus, "Woman, what have you to do with making such promises? See that you do it not again. We must in all things wait upon the will of the Father in heaven." Mary, the mother of Jesus, was crushed. She was stunned. As she stood there before him, motionless, with a tear streaming down her face, the human heart of Jesus was overcome with compassion for the woman who had borne him in the flesh. And bending forward, he laid his hand tenderly upon her head, saying, "Now, now, Mother Mary, grieve not over my apparently hard sayings, for have I not many times told you that I have come only to do the will of my heavenly Father? Most gladly would I do what you ask me, if it were a part of my Father's will." And Jesus stopped short. He hesitated. Mary seemed to sense that something was happening. Leaping up, she threw her arms around Jesus' neck, kissed him, and rushed off to the servants' quarters, saying, "Whatever my son does that, whatever my son says that, do." But Jesus said nothing. He now realized that he had already said, or rather, desirefully thought, too much. Mary was dancing with glee. She did not know how the wine would be produced, but she confidently believed that she had finally persuaded her firstborn son to assert his authority, to step forward and claim his position and exhibit his messianic power. And because of the presence and association of certain universe powers and personalities, of which all those present were wholly ignorant, she was not to be disappointed. The wine Mary desired, and which Jesus, the God-man, humanly and sympathetically wished for, was forthcoming. Near at hand stood six water pots of stone filled with water, holding about 20 gallons apiece. This water was intended for subsequent use as the final in the final purification ceremonies of the wedding celebration. The commotion of the servants about these huge stone vessels under the busy direction of his mother attracted Jesus' attention, and going over, he observed that they were drawing wine out of them with a pitcherful. He was gradually dawning on Jesus what had happened. Of all persons present at the marriage feast of Cana, Jesus was the most surprised. I think it's one of the first passages in all the papers. Others had expected him to work a wonder, but that was just what he had purposed not to do. And then the Son of Man recalled the admonition of his personalized thought adjuster in the hills. He recounted how the adjuster had warned him about the inability of any power or personality to deprive him of the creator prerogative of independence of time. On this occasion, power transformers, technicians, and all other required personalities were assembled near the water and other necessary elements, and in the face of the expressed wish of the universe, creator sovereign, there was no escaping the instantaneous appearance of wine. And this occurrence was made doubly certain, since the personalized adjuster had signified that the execution of the Son's desire was in no way a contravention of the Father's will. But this was in no sense a miracle. No law of nature was modified, abrogated, or even transcended. Nothing happened but the abrogation of time in association with the celestial assembly of the chemical elements requisite for the elaboration of wine. At Cana, on this occasion, the agents of the Creator made wine just as they do by the ordinary natural process, except that they did it independently of time and without the intervention of superhuman agencies in the matter of the space assembly of the necessary chemical ingredients. When the servants drew this new wine and carried it to the best man, the ruler of the feast, and when he had tasted it, he called to the bridegroom, saying, "It is the custom to set out first the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, to bring forth the inferior fruit of the vine. But you have kept the best of the wine until the last of the feast." Mary and the disciples of Jesus were greatly rejoiced at the supposed miracle which they thought Jesus had intentionally performed. But Jesus withdrew to a sheltered nook of the garden and engaged in serious thought for a few brief moments. He finally decided that the episode was beyond his personal control under the circumstances, and, not being averse to his Father's will, was inevitable. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about this big blue book. And then, if you'd like, we can discuss whatever parts of it you'd like to talk about. I found this book a fascinating publication. I've known about it for over 20 years, and I've read it many, many times. And I'd like to tell you what it means to me. For the first time in my explorations of things philosophical, metaphysical, cosmological, religious, scientific, I find a story in which there's no conflict between science and religion, and where philosophy is accorded its proper place as a mediator between them. I find an intriguing story which stimulates faith on the one hand and stimulates common sense on the other. This book looks pretty esoteric as you look at it. Believe me, it's not esoteric, it is exoteric. And I use these terms in the old Pythagorean sense. You were an exoteric before you became an esoteric. This book is not for an inner circle. This book is for every Tom, Dick, and Harry that's interested in reading it. far from being mysterious or mystical, it's one of the most down-to-earth tales I've ever read. The only way I know of testing truth is to try to live it. It's the only known proof for truth. You can live this book. You can live this book without being a fool. You can live this book without wearing sackcloth and ashes. You can live this book as a very practical citizen, a useful citizen. In fact, a more interesting citizen than otherwise. We're talking about where we are and where God is, and I was reminded that the use of the Greek alphabet short circuits all of the terms in this book. This book teaches me that I live on a place which we might call Alpha, and there are many of these alphas, many worlds on which people evolve as they evolved on this world. This book teaches me that God, deity, is situated at a point which we will call Omega, and it's at the center of all things. Now, we can imagine what another inhabited world would be like. That's not too tough. We could make it larger, smaller, hotter, colder. We could change the electrical potential. But Beta is, of course, the point of greatest interest. Where do we go when we leave here? This book instructs me that Jesus was speaking quite literally when he said, "In my Father's house are many mansions." And these mansion worlds are what I mean when I refer to Point Beta, the place we go when we leave here, when we graduate from here, in other words, when we die. This book teaches that death is a form of graduation. When we get to Point Beta, we're not exactly material, and we certainly aren't spiritual. I'm so relieved at the thought that I won't be catapulted by the alchemy of death into a state of absolute blessedness, because if I woke up a perfect being, it would take God himself all of future eternity to convince me it was me. And incidentally, I would feel rather badly gypped out of all the thrilling experience of growth. When I wake up in Point Beta, I shall be comfortably near material, not quite. Paul spoke of this when he said, "In heaven they have a better substance." And this better substance could be described as an emulsion of matter and spirit. Oil and water will mix in the presence of soap, and we call that an emulsion. This better substance is matter emulsified with spirit. Mostly matter at the start, very little spirit. Mostly spirit at the end, very little matter. I'm told that at Point Beta, it's sort of like an incubator for premature children, because most of us die with too much unfinished business. And we wake up over there with all of this unfinished business to complete. The book interestingly defines the cardinal sins of mankind, not, let's say, as sexual immorality, but as, and this is much worse, equivocation, procrastination, problem avoidance, unfairness, and ease seeking. These are mammalian traits. They are subhuman holdovers, indicating that we are still entirely too mammalian and hardly adequately human. Point Beta is devoted mostly to completing the de-animalizing of folks like us. When we graduate from Beta, we will be, honest to goodness, human beings. We will be completely de-animalized. On our next step, Gamma, I'm going to run out of Greek alphabet pretty soon. That's not important. On our next step, Gamma, they unify us. We emerge from this level with a unified purpose for living. This means an ending of the civil war that goes on inside of most human beings from birth through death. We're not perfect beings, but we do have, we are mobilized beings. And even then, they don't try to spiritualize us seriously, although we're growing spiritward all along. Then they try to socialize us. They teach us ethics. They teach us the quintessence of ethics. We learn how to live with very difficult people. Not difficult because they're mean, but difficult because they are so tremendously different from us. They are designedly different. And when we have learned to live with these folks, who are the native creatures of Point Delta, we can live with about anyone. We not only have developed ethics, but we have developed excellence of technique in making ethical adjustments. And now, when they've de-animalized us, unified us internally, and socialized us, then at the next level they set out seriously to spiritualize us. And when we graduate from that level, we are first stage spirit beings. This book tells us then that of all things we begin the study of the physical universe. In other words, we really study physics and chemistry and the constitution of matter. I was rather shocked when I read that the first time, but then it occurred to me, well, how sensible. As long as I'm a material being, how can I study the material universe? But once I'm not a material being anymore, I'm outside of the material universe, now I can see it, now I can study. When we've completed that, then they tell us that we grow philosophically. Our next step is a very long one, and it involves a great growth intellectually, a growth in the comprehension of meanings. And lastly, at the next level, we complete our time-space growth in values. I would say that it's at this point we graduate from the university of time and space. And for all I know, we may have to stand an oral exam in connection with acquiring our PhD or our official tickets. And we're pretty big people now because we've graduated from this university. But the next step is we matriculate as freshmen in the University of Eternity. Then they tell us we really learn what study, true study, means. This is an adventure. All the way along, we're not just pupils, we're also teaching. They tell us that to pass a course, we must pass the most difficult examination that could possibly be contrived. We're not given a passing grade until we have demonstrated our ability and our willingness to teach that course to our juniors following along behind us. And anyone who is taught will, I know, realize that teaching is much tougher than passing an examination. Somewhere in our progress through the University of Eternity, at one of the levels in there, and there are seven of them, we move in as a visitor to Omega to become acquainted with God. And when we have finished our course in the University of Eternity, we spend some time at Point Omega. And then we are commissioned, and I'll use the word eternaliter to indicate our status. We have embarked upon the eternal service of deity. And we, in turn, pay out for what we have received. In other words, we participate in the running of this wide-spreading universe of universes, about 1/7 of which we perceive as the Milky Way. That's the most intriguing story told in this big blue book. That story runs all the way through part one and part two of the book. Part three is the history of our world. It starts out with the nebula which gave origin to the sun, and then traces through the birth of our solar system, the geobiologic story of the planetary past, pretty well running parallel with the long calendar of geologists, not the short calendar. Geologists disagree as to how old this planet is. The book tends to validate the longer-term estimates. It tells the story of racial evolution on this world, and it's fascinating. The story of the first human family. The story of the first human beings who mutated out of the animal level around 1 million years ago. It explains some paradoxes in archaeology. It explains why the Foxhall people in England are so superior to the Neanderthalers and so much older. The story goes on through the whole million-year history of man on Earth, his ups and his downs. I was terribly surprised to read that Adam and Eve were real people, but they weren't the first people. They arrived about 37,000 years ago, and the human race is 1 million years old. But it tells me why Cain was able to find a wife in the land of Nod. Now, it's rather peculiar. When they edited the Old Testament, they didn't edit quite carefully enough. This book tells the story of later racial evolution. It just about hooks up with where archaeologists have dug back. It tells the story of the evolution of religion in Part 3. That's the longest subdivision in Part 3, starting out with fear and ending with a mixture of fear and love, and in the higher religions, more love than fear. It tells the story of each of the great religions that have lived here on Earth. This book goes on to discuss the modern problems of religion. It discusses not only the past of religion, but the present problems of religion. And then it takes up a very interesting story. There's a whole group of papers which discuss the meaning of that biblical statement that something about the true light which lighteth every man that cometh into the world. This discusses the indwelling of God. We're taught in this book that God indwells each of us. And incidentally, that concept is found in almost every religion. In the Quran, it says, men search for me afar off, and I'm nigher to him than his own jugular vein. This story of the indwelling of God is one of the most inspiring things in this book. This is not, we're not dual people. This is not a person that lives in us. This is a piece of God, just as you would tear off a piece of a newspaper. This is not all of the newspaper, but it's true paper, just like the newspaper. This is what draws us into Point Omega, because this piece that came out from God wants to go back there. And if we have any brains and don't louse up this thing beyond all recognition, we can travel back to Omega with this piece of God. The relationship of this indwelling spirit is like, to us, is like the relationship of a pilot to a captain of a ship. This indwelling spirit knows exactly how to get to Omega. It's going to take a long time. But having come out from there, he knows the road back. And he'll take us there if we, as captain, will give him permission and authority. The only thing that can stop him from bringing us there is us, our choosing not to go. Parts 1, 2, and 3 are tremendously intriguing stories. Part 4 is the most valuable part of this book. Part 4 is the story of the life and teachings of Jesus. And believe me, it reads like a novel. There are sections in the other parts that are a bit rough going. They're deep concepts. You don't chew them up. They've got to dissolve slowly under the tongue of your intellect. But Part 4, for the most part, it's the story of the life of one person. It's the story of the early first century goings-on in the Commonwealth of Israel. It's a story of two people who had children, the first of whom was quite unusual. It's the story of the growth of a little boy, and that's always an interesting story. It's the story of his school years. It's the story of what an interesting pupil he was. He was a walking question mark. It's the story of his ideals and his disappointments, and of some of the hubbub he raised around Nazareth, because he was a very active person. I think perhaps the most interesting part of that story to me is the story of his early adult life, his adventures, his accomplishments as a young man in his 20s, as he is beginning to acquire that wisdom, marshal that knowledge, and mobilize that experience, which he so eloquently revealed in his public career. There's a piece of advice which he gave a rich Roman senator on the nature of wealth that is the most unique treatise on economics I have ever read in my life. It is not socialistic, it is not capitalistic, it is strictly Jesusonian. You read it and you'll simply chuckle and say, that's so simple, why didn't I think of it myself? But I've never read it anywhere else. And then there's the story of his public life. And so many things are unscrambled, put in place. The story of the 12 apostles, which is the longest single chapter in this book, is one of the most moving tales I've ever read in my life. The story of those 12 men and of the impact which Jesus made on their lives. And on through to the story of the last tragic week in Jerusalem. Gee, there's five whole papers here on the Last Supper. I think the thing is reproduced practically verbatim. And then his tragic death, and what ensued after the time of the tomb. This is the structure of the Urantia book. This is what the book is all about. Philosophically, this book means a great deal to me because it helps me to avoid the two major errors in human thinking which seem to characterize most societies, most civilizations. This book helps me not be a spiritist. A spiritist, I would say, well, a good Buddhist would be like this. He just says the physical world isn't real, let's not bother about it. A good Hindu, a thinking Hindu, knows this is true too. A medieval Christian simply said, when trouble hit him, the Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away, blessed be the name of the Lord. Now, the revolt against that is a humanistic secular revolt. Starting with the Renaissance in Italy, men dug up the concepts of early Greek civilization and began thinking. And they said, now wait a minute. Sure, the Lord giveth, but I'm not so sure it's the Lord that's taking away. Let's do something about plagues and lack of sanitary conditions and human comforts. And the result has been the flowering of a wonderful materialistic civilization. But as men began to attack superstition, they wound up by attacking religion as such. And today, we ignore God. We've fallen in love with science. And today we're in trouble. Because if we leave God out of the picture, we can't stop worshiping. Men are incurably worshipful. And when they stop worshiping God, they tend to worship power. And as they begin to worship power, they end by worshiping the state. And if they start out conservative, they end fascist. And if they start out liberal, they end communist. And I can't see much difference between one and the other. And so our tremendous secular civilization that's done so much for us materially has now got us to the place where for the first time the whole human race is scared. In my generation, We have scientifically killed more people than have been killed by war in the last 2,000 years. This is not the way to do it. This book tells me that the only way you can whip matter is with mind. When man attacks his material environment thinking and scientifically, he wins. He doesn't win by praying. But if you don't ally mind with spirit, then the power that you develop in whipping your environment begets fear, not trust. And I submit that's exactly the condition the world is in today. This book admonishes me that because I am a person, I can make decisions, I have relative free will, and I can take this matter-whipping, matter-dominating mind and subordinate it to spirit. And then, any power which such a spirit-led mortal has, such power begets no fear. This book teaches me that when I deal with matter, I should be hard-headed and use reason, mathematics, and science. But when I'm dealing with values, I should use faith. I should generate a religion. This book teaches me that neither science nor religion, in their pure states, touch at any point, but that both are intriguingly touched by philosophy, where it is my privilege to attempt to use logic in the pursuit of truth and the elaboration of meanings. These papers teach me that God is love, and that love is the desire to do good to others. That's the Urantia book to me, in non-technical terms. The only technical term I used was Urantia. Do you want to discuss it at all? Yes.
When you say that God is, there's a peace of God is within us, do you feel that, it's hard to say that you're centered. I have thought, perhaps this is incorrect, but I have thought that all of us are complete worlds within ourselves, but connected to the one.
To the God, Father?
Yes. And that when you find your center, all things are possible.
Yes, agreed.
And it's a point of balance, and that is God.
This piece,
which is a complete...
Yes. The papers teach, I call these the papers because they refer to themselves as papers rather than chapters. Mm-hmm. I could say the chapters teach, but they list themselves as paper one, paper two, paper three. Why they didn't call them chapters, I don't know. The book teaches that each person is linked to God by a circuit, and that in the case of human beings, there's a double linkage, not only a circuit, which causes us to have relative free will, and as far as God's concerned, absolute free will, but also this peace is pulling us in, and that our job is to find God on the outside, at the center of all things, at Omega, through collaboration with this peace of God on the inside. These papers teach that the human soul is conceived when this peace of God invades the human mind. And the soul is a new entity, and it's actually conceived, and we are carrying our souls around, so to speak, in embryo, and at death, the soul is born.
Would that be what is called the silver cord? Is that the...
I don't know that
connection?
Term.
Have you heard that? Well,
I don't know the term, so I can't answer that.
It's almost an electrical. Could it be likened to an electrical?
Well, only on the human end.
I see.
The mind of man is certainly electrical. Mm-hmm. And the mind of man is the mother of the evolving soul. This invading peace of God is the Father. and the invasion of the mind results in a conception. Yes, Mr. Kim.
Yeah, now I'm confused here with this concept. That with the death, our soul is born.
Yes.
Now what happened before that?
The soul in embryo. Exactly. We're carrying the soul.
Now,
it's a period of gestation of the soul, just like a baby.
Now, is this,
it lives 9 months before it's born. And so the soul lives within the womb of the human mind for many years before it's born.
I'm dealing with a soulless life, I mean embryonic soul in myself. I thought we have the potential, the immanent God, the potential within us, and it depends on our inner awareness, whether how much this God quality within us we become aware of it,
yes.
Or awaken.
Yes.
So that even with living, we have a tiny little bit of it.
Yes, exactly. Yes, quite.
Definitely.
Or should I say, Yagi this?
Oh, and I was thinking also of God with, Christ with him. How is this idea that we are talking so often in our, at least I'm thinking often and hear about it, the idea of Christ within, the center within us, that we have the Christ quality also within us.
The peace of God is within us.
Yeah.
The Spirit of Christ, or the Spirit of Truth, as the book refers to it, is immediately around us. And there is a possibility of collaboration between these two spiritual influences, as there is among all spiritual influences which may touch us. Yes, the book teaches the presence of both spirits. But the Spirit of Truth is an influence that impinges on us, whereas this peace, this fragment of God, is actually within us. This fragment of God is intended to be the spirit nucleus of an absolutely stable nature around which we can grow.
Yeah.
And the book teaches me that as long as that spirit nucleus is the massive and stable center of my personality system, I'm going on. And the only way I can really mess it up is if I try to put myself in the place of that spirit nucleus. Myself functions as an orbital electron. It's not of nuclear mass.
Fritz Kunkel said that was your ego.
Yes, that's right. Such a nuisance.
Different ways of saying.
Yes. The ego is such a nuisance, but if we didn't have them, we'd be awfully dead, wouldn't we?
What do you do with the phrase, unless ye are born again, we cannot enter?
That birth is a... Let me paraphrase that. You have been born once as an animal, and you may live as an animal and die as an animal. Philosophically speaking, never once rising above the mere animal urge to live. Unless you can be further born as a true human being, you're not a son of God. And this means, philosophically, you pass from the animal urge to live to an espousal of the quest to master the human art of living. Behavior becomes conduct because there is purpose behind it, intelligent purpose. These are the philosophical repercussions as I see them. Spiritually, you develop new qualities of love. You don't cease to be selfish. But to selfishness, you now add altruism, the will to service. You desire to do good to others. This to me, the rebirth that Jesus talked about is a complete spiritual thing. But I understand it better if I put it in the words I've just used. Stop being a mammal and start being a real, true, human being.
Do you mean with killing the, or outgrowing the animal nature, not being directed anymore by our instinctual drives and all what Freud tells us? Sex drive and instinctual drive. And
this you can't escape as long as you have the chemistry of endocrinology within you. As long as you have ductless glands, you're going to have these drives, but they can be sublimated. They do not have to be expressed animalistically.
Yeah, so we master them.
Yes. We live with them. We harmonize them. We never stop being mammalian, but we stop living like mammals.
Well, how many stages can we go through in this life as of now? I mean, we do progress. And can't you...
The papers tell us that we go through 7 levels. But we may die on any one of these. That's why beta has to have grades in it. Beta has got to be able to accommodate Dr. Schweitzer and Mr. Hottentot. And Mr. Hottentot's a good citizen, you know? So beta has got to be very primitive and simple in its lower levels and quite complicated. And beta has got to accommodate people who come from planets perhaps far in advance of us in civilization. Where were we?
I just wondered, in this life now.
They tell us that there are 7 levels that we go through. Now, we're not particularly conscious of these. They tell us we have 7 grades which we should traverse, but unfortunately, death usually catches us before we graduate. So what is undone here must be completed on beta. When you study what they say about beta or the mansion worlds, then you realize that everybody gets a pretty square deal. Because what we miss here, we will get up there, or we will get the nearest equivalent that we can get. Some things are unique in this life. We can't exactly get them on the mansion worlds, but we can get at least a good ersatz, a good substitute. Yes?
Would you say something about prayer? If it's any good, who you pray to?
Well, prayer.
Anything on that?
How about helping the people that just do his prayer? How about helping some of these people? Is that part of what he's talking about? Can we do that?
The papers say this about prayer. First of all, prayer is not worship. Because prayer usually asks for something, and worship asks for nothing. They tell us that most of our worship we're not really conscious of. It takes place on the superconscious level of mind. The papers posit a superconscious as well as a subconscious.